From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Members of the Southwest Florida band Swamp Rats are with us in studio. Their self-described sound is Florida folk with an edge. We'll hear them perform live later this hour. But first, in a 2016 interview, award-winning historian, author, and broadcaster, Dr. Bettany Hughes noted that, quote, "It's an inconvenient truth that women have always made up 50% of the population, but only occupy about 0.5% of recorded history. Clearly something has gone wrong. The math just doesn't work. It's an unfortunate reality that the roles women have played in history and the impact they've had often remains diminished in our collective conscious. And despite the many remarkable stories of brave, ingenuitive, enterprising, and pioneering women, their contributions are often written out of history instead of written into our history books." Well, our guests today are among those working to change that. They're the hosts of the new podcast, Cool Dead Women, utilizing all kinds of research and interviews with scholars, filmmakers, librarians, and others. The podcast reveals the true stories of remarkable women that are too often lost to history. The first episode premiered in November in Ms. Magazine's blog, and now the producers are putting out regular episodes available through iTunes and Spotify. Soon they'll be releasing an episode about a notable woman right here in Southwest Florida, who, among other things, became the first elected woman mayor in the South. And one thing that makes this podcast even more special is that the hosts are a mother-daughter team. Joining me now in studio is Erica Waters and Blair Waters. Erica is a professor emeritus at the University of the Virgin Islands on St. Croix. She was the founding editor of the university's literary magazine, Caribbean Writer, and edited collections of fiction, poetry, literary criticism, and drama. She earned her Ph.D. in post-colonial literature, specializing in recovery research in women's literature. She's a past recipient of National Endowment for the Humanities grants, and she's a Fulbright scholar to Finland. She's written books about Maine and the Virgin Islands, along with articles and reviews for such publications as the Chronicle of Higher Education, World Literature Today, and the Women's Review of Books, among others. She first appeared on WGCU's Gulf Coast Live back in 2016 for a conversation about her book, Discovering Old Florida, A Guide to Vintage South and Central Florida. Since relocating here to Southwest Florida, Dr. Waters has been teaching writing and literature at the Renaissance Academy of Florida Gulf Coast University and has written for the Marco Island Historical Society. Dr. Waters, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
And we're also speaking with her daughter, Blair Waters. Blair grew up on St. Croix and is now a Brooklyn-based film director. Her work has been featured on MTV Hits of the Week and in the New York Times as part of the Clio Award-winning campaigns. She also works as a music journalist for national publications such as Nylon and is an internationally charting solo artist herself. She recently produced and directed her first short film on Marco Island titled Princess Rita. Blair Waters, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi.
And the conversation you're hearing broadcast now was actually recorded ahead of time, so we won't be taking calls from listeners during the show, but you can still get in touch with us with your comments and questions online. Write to us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU, using the hashtag GCL. And first of all, what set the two of you on this mission, as you write, to rescue women's lives from oblivion? Because, Erica, given your academic and personal interests in history, this podcast seems like a natural, you know, extension of your interests and your skill set. But, Blair, what made you want to do this with your mom?
I think that it's – we both are fascinated by women that have been forgotten by history, more so myself in music. There's nothing like finding someone that it feels like it's your own. And I think that you know, with your early research in Jyn Reese and Una Marson, I think I probably learned that from you, like that joy of discovery. I don't know. What do you think?
It's special to both of us, you know, to discover these women. I mean, they've been forgotten and they don't deserve to be forgotten. A lot of them have done really important things in literary history and in my view. And I think they deserve to be better known. And I feel like I'm doing something good for them. But also we started because we were talking about this somewhat obscure jazz artist called Blossom Dearie. And we started thinking that not too many people know about her. I mean, I discovered her because some friends' parents liked her. And we thought, you know, we should talk about Blossom and let her be better known, too. And so that's where we got started.
Interesting, interesting. Well, let's go ahead and hear a segment now from your episode about Alice Ball. And before we just hear this short excerpt, do you want to set that up for us a little bit?
Yes. Well, Alice Ball was, certainly deserves to be better known. I don't want to take away from the segment, but she discovered an early cure for leprosy. She was an African-American woman who moved to Hawaii, and she was an early graduate of the University of Hawaii on Oahu. And she worked very hard to try to find this cure. There's a leper colony in Hawaii. It's actually still there, only the people there are there voluntarily. And she worked hard. She found a cure. And then she sort of mysteriously died.
Well, it wasn't mysterious.
Well, we have theories.
Yeah.
The story of Alice Augusta Ball reveres truth about academia, while at the same time revealing sexism and racism. She was a black woman, and ageism too. She was only 24 when she made her startling medical breakthrough. And this drama took place where you'd least expect it, amid the swaying palms and tropical sand beaches of Hawaii over a century ago.
Well, you can listen to the episode to find out more, but basically she was murdered.
No, I don't think we can say she was murdered, honestly. It was mysteriously...
Shh, we'll let them listen.
Okay, we'll find out.
Okay.
I think it's a wonderful story because there was a doctor, another professor who tried to help her and he was ignored. So.
It's outrageous. It's really outrageous like when you look into it, and I think that's something... I mean, I get angry when I think about... Like, I don't know about you, but like I get kind of angry when I think about these women.
Yeah. This seems truly like a labor of love, you know, given that the whole point of the project is to uncover stories of women in history that have largely been written out of history. So that's got to make your background research especially challenging. Tell me about how you prepare. Where do you go for research, and how do you even stumble across these stories in the first place?
We were talking about this today, that, you start looking at one woman and then something else, another name comes up, and then you Google that and then you find some more things. I was interested to find out that there are clips on YouTube that I didn't even know about with some of these women. And I was actually seeing them alive, or I actually heard Jean Reese's voice, which was amazing to me. So it's wide ranging. And that's what we love about this, because we're able to pick our own subjects and we don't have to worry about deadlines except the ones we impose ourselves. And we can order books and look at archival footage. I mean, it's very exciting for me.
I think for a lot of the lesser known people that we're covering, like there's two stories that come to mind. One of them is the Paul I can't even pronounce his last name.
Paul Wergamer, the retired librarian in Hawaii, and that's connected with the Alice Ball story.
Yeah, so like he's – it's a lot of it is private people doing research, and so you Google it, you find like this one person. Like the one that I did a piece on Connie Converse, who's a really pioneering singer-songwriter, and there's a girl in North Carolina who has the contents of the file cabinet that she left behind, and she was just – sent me these – she's like, oh yeah, I'll just go scan them in. And she scanned in like this woman's like disappearance note, and like for me as like a huge fan, like that was so exciting. And so a lot of times it is people who've come before us, and like we owe a great debt to them, who have done a lot of the collecting.
It's interesting the links you're going to find this information. Well, that you have to, because of the way it hasn't been recorded properly, and the way you were talking about your emotional reaction, like getting angry at some of the injustices you come across, is that maybe just an extension of the depth of research you do? You get so immersed in these people's lives. Mm.
As somebody who's done a lot of original research about people, you kind of do fall in love with your subjects somehow, and you feel like you're fighting for them, and you want you know, the right to be done by them. What's interesting too is that we've had to find a kind of middle ground here. We can't talk about – we can't research when there's no research available. If we can't find anything, we have to kind of just say these people are too long forgotten. You know, we can't do them. So and yet we don't want to do people that everybody knows about. There's no point in that. So we're kind of finding a middle ground.
But it's also kind of immediate, like going back to Connie, like if that woman hadn't done those interviews with Connie's brother that year, he died the next year. Mm. So it's like it's important that like people get interested in this stuff now to save the people from like even like who were active in like the 50s and 60s.
Right.
And the research I did on Una Morrison, I was over there, you know, I was drinking rum at 9 o'clock in the morning just so I could get an interview so that people who knew Una Morrison could tell me about her.
And who was Una Morrison?
She was the first female woman writer of significance in the Caribbean. And she really – she wrote poetry and she wrote plays, and she was largely forgotten for many years. So I did work on her.
That is number eight, I believe.
Number eight.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about the woman featured in your upcoming Cool Dead Women podcast episode, who was the first elected mayor in the South. And right here in Southwest Florida, this seemed particularly remarkable to me because when I think about feminism or generally progressive ideology and try to link that to a specific geographic location, the city of Moorhaven in Glades County doesn't exactly top my list. Tell me about Marion Newhall Horwitz.
Well, Marion Newhall was a Philadelphia debutante, I guess socialite, and her father was a famous cricketer and also a Philadelphia bank executive, and she was brought up in very pampered surroundings. But she married at 21. An older man who was a lawyer, George Quintard Horowitz. And he was also from a Philadelphia family. And they had two children. And somewhere along the line, he got this plan to move to the Everglades. He must have had a very adventurous spirit. And they were all set to go. He had a partner named James J. O'Brien, who was a Philadelphia newspaper man. And then George died. And so Marion was confronted with the dilemma: should she go with, you know, the partner and move to the wilds of Florida? And at that time, I mean, we are really talking the beginning of the 20th century, and she wasn't in the cities. You know, she wasn't on the coast where the tourists were starting to come and the railroads. She was in the middle of really nowhere, of cattle ranches.
Yeah,
right? They were having cattle, you know, going through the center of town in
cattle drives.
Cattle drives,
yeah, going
yes.
down to Ponderosa.
Right. Mm. So it was really a different world. Very different, and besides, of course, heat and mosquitoes and all the other things. But she went. She decided to go.
And she came as a widow.
She came as a widow. Mm. And she had a 2,000-acre farm, and she used to ride her horse around it. And so so James J. O'Brien and she were partners and eventually married, but the two of them together went and started a bank, and she became the president. And they started a fruit exchange, and she was in charge. She started a women's club. Of course, she was in charge. They included a public library. She was doing everything. And then they decided to give women the right to vote. Now, this is in 1917, so it's 3 years before the amendment to give women the right to vote. What happened at the time was that individual states and could allow women to vote, but it hadn't become national until 1920. So she was elected mayor. She became the first mayor.
Would Moorhaven have even been put on the map if not for the work of her and O'Brien? I mean, with everything that they happened there and even lobbying for a railroad stop even coming through there, because I would imagine that if you didn't have a railroad stop at that time, that's totally going to limit any kind of community or economic growth.
Absolutely. And that was very important because during World War I, they started sending produce to the troops and Moorhaven was famous for that, you know, and very, very important. But what happened with them, and I guess I talk about this on the podcast, is that they were outsiders, and you know, they were seen as Philadelphians, and then it got into religion because they were Catholics, and they were given a hard time. And one man wrote about it, and of course you always have to check your research. I only read this in one place that they were called the Duke and Duchess or the Lord and Lady. You know, they had problems, and then Marion hired African-American workers to come into the fields, and that really was very difficult in that town at that time. And she took her guns and tried to defend the workers, and people shot at her.
Wow.
So she grazed her head is what they said. So when he came back from the war, they decided to move to Clewiston, and they're responsible for starting the whole sugar companies there.
That's just amazing because, you know, that industry, of course, continues to dominate and characterize that area today.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. And, you know, I took a lot of literature courses in college, and there was one I took on 20th century American women literature, and our text was an anthology of women's writing titled Available Means. And the title was taken from Aristotle's famous definition of rhetoric being the ability in each particular case to see the available means of persuasion. And the reason the authors of this anthology used Aristotle's definition of rhetoric in the title was based on this concept that ancient Greek philosophers, all men, didn't really have to consider how the available means of persuasion would be for women. For men, they just took for granted the right to speak in public at all. And so how that had shaped women's writing, because, you know, when you're fighting for your space in the world, that's going to change the sorts of things you're even going to be talking about. And I bring that up because you had talked earlier about, you know, Marion being elected 3 years before the 19th Amendment taking effect. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, is it important to you in each of these stories to include that kind of historical context? Because I imagine what makes what Marion did so much more remarkable is because as a woman, in a lot of ways, she had to work twice as hard to get half as far.
I mean, I think just when you said the thing about the textbook, I think something that fascinated me when I first did this was, Mom, tell them about what when you first started teaching women's literature.
I don't know.
There wasn't a textbook when she started teaching women's literature, which blew my mind.
I know. I forgot.
I still think about that. And I'm like, how is that? Like, and that's when she, like, this woman right here, not a day over 30, when she started teaching. Like, that is so mental to me.
Well, I taught the first women's literature class in the Caribbean, basically. I mean, as far as I know anyway. And I had to go Xerox all the materials and bring them to class and – we did have copier machines then, actually, way back then, in prehistoric times. But I had to do all that. But I was going to say something about the context becomes very important, the historical context. I when I write my podcast, I always do that because I think people probably don't really know about what the times were like, in Una Morrison's time. And we found, like, Una Morrison, who was the woman I was talking about, who was the first female writer, Caribbean woman writer of significance, she suffered from mental problems all the time. I mean, the pressures to be the first in your field and to be a pioneer must be incredible.
Yeah.
I think it's also easy to think about it in an abstract sense and like how – and you can look back on it with extreme romanticism. But like as someone who's like 10% of females are directors and like 2% of females are music producers and like it's not fun. Like it sounds real cool like at the end of the day, but it's like when it's awful. It's like really just isn't fun. And so I think like doing thinking of it in that context, you have to have some kind of like empathy for them. And so like showing their I think we do a good job with like not we talk about depression and like and the stuff that comes with it a lot. And a lot of the women we're doing do suffer from depression and like alcoholism and things like that. And I don't think we're sugarcoating their struggles at all.
No. But I think we're doing one on Leonie Van Zesch, who was the first female dentist in Alaska. And she's coming up soon. And she cleaned cavities with hairpins.
Wow.
Isn't that awful? Isn't that awful? But she really, really had trouble being a woman in Alaska, which shouldn't surprise us, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, at first it wasn't clear to me how much trouble she had, but she had to get checks written using her initials so that people didn't know she was a woman. And, you know, and as soon as some places found out she was a woman, they let her go.
Yeah. I like the idea that you don't sugarcoat their lives. If there's something, you know, perhaps negative or something that they struggled with, like that's part of the complexity that makes them a whole
Absolutely.
Person.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm sorry, Blair, I cut you off.
Oh, no. I was just going to say like – and it's easy to think of something like that, like using your initials as like something that happened 100 years ago. But even if you think about like J.K. Rowling, like would she have been that successful if – you know, it's like it's still so prevalent now. And like there are millions of like super important women being forgotten every day, you know?
So learning from the past, really.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that much.
Yeah.
I think something else that kind of maybe dates the Mary and Newhall story is that she and John O'Brien were both active in the anti-prohibition movement.
I know.
Interesting.
Yeah, which who knew there was such a thing, really, yeah. to that extent?
Yeah. I mean, I've read stories about, you know, like Carrie Nation coming down here with her hatchet during prohibition. But you don't hear too much about folks from Florida being part of the anti-movement unless they were bootleggers themselves.
Wasn't my mother – I'll just call you mommy. My mother had the thing tell them about Lady Hooch. I told her this person was not cool enough to do, but she does have a thing with this person. I don't – Lady Hooch.
Well, we discuss what is cool. You know, we
had
to
kind of conversation to have with your mom.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, what is cool? So we decided that the women we were going to do, they had to be interesting. They had to make some sort of contribution to the world. They had to do something of significance. And so I came across this woman who was the Lady Hooch Hunter, she was known as. And what she did was turn people in who were breaking the laws, the prohibition laws.
Oh.
So we decided she wasn't cool.
I guess Carrie Nation would go in there too if she. Okay, all right.
But there are so many of these like super interesting people that we want to still talk about, but that aren't necessarily cool. Like the radio, I think the Radium Girls are super. Like, you know, people like that, like people that are.
You know,
just
about
like
the Radium Girls.
Yes, I actually have a friend of mine who's a musician in Boston, and her. She's in a girl punk rock band, and they're called the Radium Girls, sort of in reference to that. Yeah.
Well, we kind of decided the Radium Girls were too well known.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
Even though it's an interesting story, you know. Yeah. So that's the example of what you have to just sort of – it's interesting, but we won't do it.
Yeah.
But also something when you're doing like audio, the thing with the Radium Girls is the visuals with them is what's so cool. And so you kind of have to – if you're doing things just audio, you can't do that. You can't be like, think of this photo, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I guess if your makeup's glowing in the dark,
right.
Take it off. Well, let's switch gears a little bit. And Blair, tell us about your short film, which, you know, you've shot and directed on Marco Island here in Southwest Florida. First, we have a little audio excerpt. Do you want to set something up for us about what we're about to hear?
The film is about kind of a lonely insurance adjuster who floats from hotel to hotel, and he has become consumed with his love for his internet girlfriend. And this is the first opening of the film.
Okay.
In the dream, I picked you up at the airport in Miami, and we hit the road to assess the damage at a mobile home park flattened by a tornado. I'm telling you now, the stuff we'll see every day will be pretty rough, Rita. People's homes flooded, old ladies with bruised ribs from tripping over their own doorways. But when you're finally here, it'll all be bearable. And I'll do whatever it takes to finally get you here.
And that was an excerpt from our guest Blair Waters' first short film, which was shot here in Southwest Florida on Marco Island. And the story is based on a true story, I understand?
My writer, it's based on kind of her imagining of her father's life. There are definitely like a lot of like true elements to it.
It's called Princess Rita.
Yeah. What made you want to tackle this particular story?
I'm obsessed with the idea of like America. I didn't grow up here. And so Florida to me is this really fascinating kind of microcosm of America. There's so much. There's this poem. I've been trying desperately to find it and I can't find it. But it's this beautiful poem about how like Florida has the most things that are gorgeous that can kill you. In a state. That's kind of how I'm thinking about this film. Like there's so much like hidden dangers everywhere in Florida while underneath this whole idea that it's like this place to go to be happy.
Hmm.
So I thought it was the perfect place to shoot it. Yeah. Hmm.
And tell us about the star of the film. I understand we can actually see him in The Haunting of House Hill now on Netflix also.
Yeah. His name is Fedor. And he's actually a math teacher here. But he's like really talented actor and like he's not like a young kid. But like as of late, he's been getting all these huge roles. Was this magical thing for me to find. I still don't remember how I found him, but he's really someone to watch, I think.
All right. Well, tell us about some of your other film work, because I know it's been featured in some pretty big publications.
Yeah, I started out doing music videos. I was very into like punk when I was younger, and so it was like a lot of stuff with that. And then I moved into working at magazines. And so for a couple of years, I worked primarily at magazines in New York and done stuff for like Elle and like Harper's and like Nylon. I worked at forever. So it was mostly fashion stuff. And then I moved into music videos. I've done music videos for tons of labels. And now I've just this year started doing narrative filmmaking. So it's been kind of a backwards motion. Yeah.
And your music interest, this stems from you being a musician yourself.
Well, it's weird. That actually came afterwards.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I made music for the first time 2 years ago. I still don't really like, I play guitar, but I'm terrible. But yeah, it came afterwards, which is bizarre. And yeah, but yeah, that's been super fun. And it's been like a great, I mean, especially like, if, like as an editor, like if you're like editing stuff for like days on end, it's really nice to have something creative to do.
Yeah. And you've got music out there that, our listeners could check out.
Oh yes. My name is Gussie. It's named after my beloved dead dog. yeah, you can find it on Spotify. I'm very popular in France. Not so much in America. Huh. But yeah.
How would you characterize your genre, your style?
It's definitely like, it's like indie pop. But it's like weird kind of indie pop. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Do you ever see yourself incorporating, you know, your own musical compositions into your film work?
Oh yeah. I mean, I do all the music in Cold Dead Women too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So I score that, and then I score most of my fashion videos. I score myself. The new film, I have Daniel Johnston who I got to do the music. He didn't do the music. I just am using one of his songs.
All right. Excellent. Well, and Erica, tell me about your teaching and writing here in Southwest Florida. What topics do you cover in courses at FGCU's Renaissance Academy?
I taught Learn to Love Poetry, which I thought was a good topic because it's kind of – poetry is a topic that – it's sort of like opera. People want to know about it but don't always. And so I taught a course in that, and I taught a course a lecture called Adventures in Vintage Land, which is based on my book, Discovering Old Florida. And I talked about where you can go on one tank of gas, things like that.
Okay. And what about writing for the Marco Island Historical Society? What is that included?
Well, I was working on their website. They were just getting their website going. And so I talked about the pioneers, and then I talked – the pioneers who settled Marco. And then I wrote about the Mackel brothers, the very current one, the history.
Yes, yes. Okay. And, you know, you lived in St. Croix, and that's where you grew up, which I think is super cool.
Thank you.
And you've lived in Maine as well. What prompted you to eventually draw a banker here in Southwest Florida, Erica?
Well, when we moved to Maine from the Virgin Islands, we didn't really know what cold was.
Yeah.
You know, we thought it was like snow. Remember when you saw snow for the first time? Blair came back in and said, "It's wet."
I didn't know that.
I know, because in the pictures, it doesn't look wet. It just looks, you know, white and fluffy. And the cold wasn't part of it. So after living in Maine for a while, I was teaching at the University of Southern Maine. And Blair was in high school. And then we decided to go find someplace warm.
So. Okay. She's leaving out a big part, which is when she moved us all to Finland.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, yeah, so we moved from Maine to Finland.
And actually, Maine is colder than Finland. I just want to say that because Finland has a terrible reputation, but Maine is actually colder.
So after that, Florida, oh my God.
Well, I was a Fulbright scholar there, so I was teaching. I mean, it wasn't like I just said, let's go to Finland, you know. So then we moved to Florida part-time. Yeah. We still live in Maine part of the year.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay. Are there any final thoughts either of you would want to leave us with about the podcast?
I just say we're having a very good time, actually. It's an opportunity to research and, you know, just go your own way. And, as an academic, I was always thinking about funding and other things and, you know, advancement. And I'm just doing women that I enjoy reading about, learning about. And you said the same thing, I think.
Yeah, I feel like it's a nice thing to do. I also think it's really exciting to, with the internet, there's obviously a lot of problems with it, but to be able to do something like this and be able to, like, potentially reached a ton of people is really exciting. I think closing, like, last things I would say is if someone has like a really great woman in their family that they want to send us, please email us.
We want nominations. That's right.
Yeah. Please email please us. Like if you, cause that, and if you want to tell us about someone in your family that like you think really made like exceptional contributions, maybe like who knows, you know?
Well, I was at the dentist and that's how I heard about Leone. My dentist made that suggestion.
Oh, all right.
So our best, in my mind, a lot of our best episodes come from just like friends who have like obsessions with people.
Interesting.
Yeah, so we'd love to hear from people.
All right. Yeah. Well, we've been speaking with author, editor, professor, and historian Dr. Erica Waters, along with her daughter, filmmaker, musician, music journalist Blair Waters, and they're the hosts and producers of the new podcast, Cool Dead Women. It's available through iTunes and Spotify. And you can also check out more about the podcast online at cooldeadwomen.com. Erica and Blair, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
This was so much fun. Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
The newest episode of Cool Dead Women, featuring the story of the South's first elected mayor, Marion Newhall, drops next week. Again, it's available through iTunes and Spotify. We're taking a short break, but when we return, members of the Florida folk band Swamp Rats are with us in studio, and they'll be performing live. Stay with us. This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU.